Welcome to Ampersound, a podcast brought to you by the team at Visualist. Ampersound features snippets from our interactive digital magazine, Ampersand. Every episode, we speak to multi-hyphenates who have captivated our minds. We ask them about their code switching, routines, and mindsets. For the full stories, check out ampersand-mag.com. That's ampersand-mag.com. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. Today, I'm joined by CEO, mental health advocate, and sari enthusiast, Poppy Jaman. We talk about recognizing and managing mental health struggles, straddling different cultures, and the magical effect of saris. Stay tuned to hear more, and we hope you enjoy the stories. I always like to start by going back to the beginning a little bit. I know you are a third generation British Bangladeshi and you grew up in Portsmouth. What was it like growing up, and what was one of the things that you were interested in as a young child growing up in Portsmouth?
I came to this country as a baby, 18 months old or something, my mum said, before the age of two. There was a tiny community of British Bengali people back then. So we were a very close community. There was 5, 6, 7 families, and we all saw each other fairly regularly. So that felt quite close. But then I think the challenges that I then sort of experienced, I would say, was when I hit teenage years and, you know, you start to go to school and the hormones kick off, and suddenly you become very self-aware as a young person that you're not like everybody else. And, you know, your family culture and practices and food and things like that separate you out from the mainstream. And even little things like, you know, I eat with my fingers and I'm great, I love it. Like, but actually at school, I remember the early days of eating with cutlery and how that was, and just this little things that make you feel different to everybody else. And I found that personally quite difficult, because I wanted to be cool, fit in. And so therefore I'd find that I sort of adapted my personality at school, and I'd pretend that, you know, I was more English than Bengali. But then of course, at home, I wasn't. I was really Bengali. And so I just found the teenage years very, very difficult. And I really felt isolated, and I felt alone quite often, because then when you looked into the community, there weren't lots of teenage girls who were similar to me. And I guess it was very difficult to find people that had a similar mindset and that you wanted to hang out with. So, yeah, I found the whole thing very distorted. And I guess this multi-hyphenates that you talk about, you know, I am Poppy, but I'm also English, and I'm also Bengali, but I also wanted to be allowed to study and be a student, but I also wanted to dance, and I also wanted to be a good sister and a good daughter. And it's just all of these roles. And I think the splintering effect that then had on my personality, trying to be all of these different people that didn't necessarily interact with each other in a safe way, had a big impact on me.
If you were to use a word to describe your teenage years, what would it be?
Struggle, I think, is probably what comes to mind. Yeah. Struggle, isolated.
Was that talked about in your family, the struggle you were feeling as a teenager?
I think it was talked about in the family, but not in a positive way. I don't think my parents or my family recognized that actually I needed support and help and conversation. It was more about, you know, you're growing up and these are the rules that you have to live by, and just a constant reminder that I was Bengali and actually I mustn't veer away from my faith, my culture, and mainly that was sort of, you know, these are the clothes you must and mustn't wear. This is the hairstyle you must or mustn't have. This is the food that you must learn how to cook. There was a lot of rules, and you must stay within the boundaries of these rules because you're a Bengali woman. So that was probably majority of the conversation within the family. And then at school, there was a couple of teachers. Mrs. Moore was one of them in my secondary school, sort of picking up on the fact that I was really struggling, that I was unhappy. And she helped to find other Bengali girls who were older than me in school to create a safe space so that I could talk. And she spent time listening to me and trying to help me navigate some of the emotional struggles that I was having. I remember Mrs. Moore calling my mum once and saying that I really wanted to do these dance classes and I was a really good dancer. And actually, she can vouch for the fact that I'm in a safe place and I'm not bunking school, and it, just reassuring my mum that it was okay to let me stay after school. So teachers like that taking an extra step to create an environment where I could do what I wanted was quite important. So yeah, I felt very frustrated and constantly torn between not disappointing my parents, but in trying to not do that, I was compromising some of my dreams and hopes. So it was a struggle.
After school, you had an arranged marriage and had your first child shortly after. And I remember reading that you had to cope with postnatal depression, anxiety. Can you share a bit about that period?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was very ambitious, I think, as a teenager. I remember feeling like I wanted to travel the world. I didn't actually want children. So that was never part of my school friends still talk about that. You know, there's one school friend who was like, I'm going to have a football team. And I was like, I'm not having any children ever. I do not need to add to the world's population. I wanted to travel and I wanted to go to university and I wanted to be something. And I don't know what that being something meant back then, but I guess my frame of reference was that women in my family didn't work and I wanted to work and I wanted to have financial independence. I shared with my parents that I wanted to go to college and university. And that was like a big deal. Wow, Poppy wants to go. What does that look like? Will that be away from home? What restrictions do we need to put in place so that she doesn't have a boyfriend and go off the rails, whatever going off the rails meant for them? So I guess what did happen was all the rules that were put around me meant that I did exactly that. I rebelled against it all. And that rebellion meant that I ran away from home. And when I ran away from home, the consequence of that was, well, I now recognize it as a forced marriage. It wasn't an arranged marriage. So I was taken back to Bangladesh and I got married. And I did that relationship for about 7 or 8 years. My first daughter was born from that relationship. She's now 25. She's amazing. She's traveled the world. When I had my first daughter, and I would have been about 20, I think, 1920. Very soon afterwards, I mean, a couple of months afterwards, I was diagnosed with postnatal depression. But I think I'm telling you the previous bit of that story because I don't think it was postnatal depression. I think the hormone imbalance that we experience as women when you have a child probably amplified it. But actually, my struggles, as I described my youth or teenageness, that was the time that my mental health struggles really started. And it was only, they only really surfaced as a young woman who'd just had a baby because you have so much medical attention at that point in time. And I just took a nosedive in terms of mental health because I remember sort of sitting in hospital and, you know, I'd just given birth and I had this amazing, beautiful thing in my arms. And I just remember thinking, I've got no idea what to do with this child. Like, what, how, I don't feel like a mother. And I felt very separate from the baby and myself. And I knew then that actually it didn't feel right, because I'd seen other friends and other women, you know, we're a Bengali family, big family, lots of always get-togethers around children and young people. And I just didn't have that connection. It was my health visitor, who was a Chinese lady, Alison. It was her that picked up on the fact that I was struggling, because I didn't know what a mental health struggle was at the time. I just thought I wasn't good enough. So I had what we would now recognize as a distorted thinking, where I was thinking, I'm not good enough, I'm not capable, I'm a failure. It was just overwhelming. So yeah, that's a bit of the story behind the mental health struggles in my early days.
Wow. And were you getting help with your mental health after Alison had noticed that you were struggling with depression?
Yeah, so I don't know what happens nowadays, but back then every couple of weeks you had to go and see your health visitor and the baby would get weighed and you'd have a little check-in. And I remember coming into the clinic for that check-in, and Alison just looked at me and went, let's go to the back room. And she was like, are you all right? And I just burst into tears. And I was just like, I'm not right. I'm not coping. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I don't think I can do this. And she actually sat me in the back room and then went and got a GP there and then. Like, and the GP saw me, and that was when I was diagnosed with postnatal depression. And then at that point, there two things happened. One was I was referred to counselling. And I was also referred to a psychiatrist, and I was three things, and then I was also given some antidepressants to try and help the situation.
Yeah, were you shocked by the diagnosis, or were you ashamed?
I remember feeling relieved and then feeling really upset. So initially feeling like, okay, there's a label for this. Yeah, okay. So I'm not incompetent and incapable, and I'm not a failure, and there is a thing that's happening. And if I can get medication for it, I didn't really know what talking therapies was at the time. I didn't know what counselling was. So it was almost irrelevant that they'd referred me to counselling, because I was just like, what is that? But the fact that medication was prescribed, I just thought, oh, okay, so I could it became tangible. And I guess, again, from a cultural perspective, if you're being treated with medication, then it's a thing that can be treated. But then when I was referred to a psychiatrist and I had my first appointment in the psychiatric hospital at the time, that was when I became really upset, because then I was like, oh, actually, I'm mad. And that comes with huge stigma and shame in our community. Like, I've heard of family members talk about other people that are mad, and what does that look like? And am I going to be like a laughing stock of the community? I remember a sort of family member saying, oh, don't tell anybody that you've gone to see a psychiatrist. It became sort of a bit of a, she's getting help, but like, don't talk about the psychiatric bit. And I realized that actually there was shame attached, and fear, I suppose, fear attached to the whole thing. So yeah, it was confusing, but I knew it wasn't a good thing on whichever way I looked at it.
Contrasting it with today, you speak so openly about mental health. How did that happen? Give me the highlights of how you got started becoming involved in campaigning for mental health, awareness, advocacy.
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious decision. So it wasn't like I thought, this is now my cause. because I've experienced discrimination or I've experienced struggle. Like it really was not. So first of all, I was doing community development work where I was supporting women's refuges and supporting women who were in refuges. And then obviously that then identified that almost all the women that were in that situation had mental health struggles. I was doing basic things like, and that came out of ESOL classes, English for Speakers of Other Languages. So I met even more broader group of women who were, trying to get into work and things like that. So I became very much an advocate of women and getting them support services. But in hindsight, I was probably doing quite a lot of healing myself by looking after other people and learning. You know, what social care was about, what domestic violence was about, what women's empowerment or disempowerment was about. So I learned a lot very quickly. And that led me to being, you know, supported very much by my line managers. I just had amazing line managers who were like, you're really great at this job. Here's a door. We're going to open that. Go on this course. You make a really good manager. Why don't you go on this course, which is a leadership program for people in the NHS? So that's how my career really developed. And then I found myself working for the Department of Health on race equality and mental health. And I guess because of the way that I came through the health and social care statutory sector organizations and my own experience, all of those things came together. And of course, I was working in mental health, but not in clinical sense, but in policy sense. How do we change mental health sector so that they are more inclusive, they are educating people, etc. That job within DH, Race Equality and Mental Health, then led to Mental Health First Aid. So we were looking at how you educate the British public on general public education for mental health. Mental Health First Aid was being rolled out in Scotland. We at DH here in England looked at it and went, let's have a go at that. A team of people were pulled together to look at that and then see if it would translate. I was part of that team. And then I got the opportunity to lead that team and take mental health out of Department of Health. And then I set it up as a social enterprise. And that became a decade's worth of everything, really, because on the one hand, I was raising a young family by this time as a single parent. And then on the other hand, my third baby was mental health first aid, because I was determined to prove to myself that women could lead businesses. Women could lead businesses that were highly ethical, which Mental Health First Aid was. It's a social enterprise. And that someone without clinical qualification could actually play a really big part in normalizing mental health in the world. I wanted to educate the world on mental health, and that was the vehicle. So that sort of led to the passion behind Mental Health First Aid. So in 2016, it was in the top 10 fastest growing women-led SMEs in the UK. And then the following year, it was in the top 500 fastest growing SMEs in Europe. So I was like, wow, did it.
Congratulations.
When
you were young, did you know what you wanted to do when you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to be an engineer.
Why an engineer?
I was really good at science. I really enjoyed, oh my God, my maths and science now, it's terrible. It's really bad, really, really bad. But I was really quite good at maths and science and sciences and electronic engineering. And I actually started a HND, Higher National Degree in Electronics Engineering at Highbury College. I did it for about half a term, and then I was taken to Bangladesh and I was married. But that's the career path that I really wanted. And I think also there weren't women in that. I think that appealed to me. I guess being a trailblazer and breaking the rules to prove something, probably.
That was always in you.
Yeah,
Yeah. What about dance? You mentioned that was part of your childhood as well, teenage years. Dance. Did you continue dancing?
No, I still hope that one day I'm going to perform on stage somewhere. So, no, I think I started I did dance for GCSEs, and that was very frowned upon by my family. It's like, what are you doing as a Bengali girl dancing on stage? And Bengali Muslim girl, I suppose. Many South Asian cultures have dance as part of their work, but not necessarily the Bengali Muslim culture. So I loved dance, and I would have loved to have pursued that in some shape or form. But it was really frowned upon by my family that I was taking dance at GCSE level. And I remember going to a few college things where they had dance schools come in from London and run workshops. And there was a couple of things that I went to, but then on the performance day, on the evening, I wasn't allowed to go to the performance. And it was just humiliating because you were letting your team down. You'll pull together this dance over a period of sessions, which were usually in school time, but then the performances would always be in the evening. And of course, my family weren't up for me going out in the evening. So I would have to make an excuse that I was unwell because I didn't want to say I'm not allowed to come to the evening dance sessions because I felt like I was losing face amongst my peers because I wasn't an independent young woman who was allowed to go out. So it's seen, and I think, I don't know how much that's changed now, but definitely back then it was seen by my family as not an honourable thing to be doing. So that dream went quite quickly. But I still, there's a little bit of me that thinks, well, maybe when I retire, I'll join a dance class.
You mentioned mental health first aid was named as one of the fastest growing SMEs in Europe. Did you feel like you had achieved something? Because I remember you saying when you had left school, you're very ambitious, you wanted to be something. Have you felt since then that you have been something or are something?
That's a really good question. Yeah, definitely. So for a long time I did that thing that again you'll see many successful women do, which is, oh, it's nothing and it's everybody else's. And it is. You can't build an organization like that by your own. You absolutely cannot do that. And actually the success of mental health first aid lies with the hundreds and thousands of people that have adopted the training, that have pushed it through. But somebody had to lead that organization and maneuver the dynamics, and that was me, and that was my executive team, and that was good advisors that sat around me, and that was being brave, not perfect. So recognizing the limitations of my education, of my upbringing, and instead of letting the imposter syndrome hold me back, people around me gave me the confidence to go, just go for it. What have you got to lose? So I think I drew a lot of strength from that. It was, if I have this conversation around mental health first aid with, I don't know, the government or a new organization, if they say no, we haven't lost anything. My confidence might be knocked a little bit, but actually they might say yes, and that might be very exciting. But I think for years I did what women do, which is go, this is everybody else and it's not me. But I think what I recognized is that how many brown women do you see coming up from the social sector that are talking about successful leadership, running a business and owning that? And if I don't do that, then I guess women like you, women like my daughters, where do they look to go, well, actually, Poppy's done this and she's an Asian woman and maybe I can do that and some. So I want to be the shoulders that the next generation of women can stand on to develop their careers, their motherhood styles, their take lessons from the stuff that I did that wasn't so great and be incredible in what you do. So yes, I do feel like I am someone.
Wow. Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. How do you take care of yourself now? How do you ensure that your mental health is well taken care of and your physical health is well taken care of?
Yeah, so I know my early warning signs like really well. And I think when you've been really unwell, most people will tell you that they've got to grips with understanding what causes them mental health challenges. I call that the stress signature. So you might have heard that your stress signature is unique to you. And stress signatures will, you know, typically be behavioral, emotional, physical. So physical, for example, I get jaw ache. Emotional, I get quite irritable and quite snappy. And then behavioral is sort of micromanaging people. So I might, you know, instead of sending one email, I might send 10 emails, which is really poor management, bearing in mind my whole organization is about workplace mental health. And so I list my early warning signs, and sometimes, and they'll change over your life as well. So it's a list that needs constantly revising. And then how do I take care of myself? I have a wellbeing toolkit. So there's another list. And again, that changes over your lifetime as well, because as I've got to know myself better, the lists have become even more fine-tuned. So on my wellbeing toolkit is yoga. I try and practice yoga at least 3 to 5 times a week, usually first thing in the morning. But having said that, the last 3 weeks I haven't, and I'm beginning to feel the impact of that. So that's a prevention strategy for me. So yoga, cold water swimming. So I've adopted that this year. So I've got to do a bit of swimming. Yeah, that's quite fun. It's very invigorating.
What does that do for you, cold water swimming?
Where do you swim? Brighton. So I live, Lewis is quite close to Brighton. So my husband and I go down to the sea, and actually it was him that introduced it to me. I was like, my DNA is not made for seawater. Like, that's not amazing. That's not, we do hot water. But actually it's been really good. So what I feel when I've been cold water swimming, and when I say swimming, I do mean like 5 minutes. I'm not talking like 25 minutes, but I feel like it's a reset. It really sharpens my thinking, and it gives me a boost of energy that seems to last 2, 3, 4 days. I just feel more alive after a cold water dip. So I thoroughly recommend it. And then what else is on my friends? A couple of, about 3 weekends ago, 4 of us met up on West Wittering's Beach, had a massive picnic. And one of the things about this friendship group was around about this time, Cherie, we wrote letters to our future selves that we were supposed to open 3 years later. Anyway, those letters got lost. They stayed with Haley. And when we met a few weeks ago, so we opened these letters something like 27 years late.
Oh, wow. Mm. What did you write to yourself?
Yeah, I can't share all of it because some of it was a bit out there, but it definitely wasn't what I predicted for my life.
Yeah, wow.
We really enjoyed reading the letters, and we were like, my goodness, you know, look at where we are now and how we thought. But what was interesting was our personality styles were still exactly the same, which made us laugh. So we're going to do another letter, and this time we're not going to give it to Hayley. We're going to give it to Moira so that they don't get lost.
In terms of your hobbies, you mentioned yoga. I think I also saw that you started taking singing lessons.
Yeah, I have.
How is that going?
Really badly.
That's the fun part. Why did you start singing lessons?
So I guess there's this thing about you asked me about dance, and I think there's still a bit of me that is
unfulfilled.
Definitely microphone. Mm. There's a performer there, and I think there's something about, do you know, I've stood on stages all around the world talking about mental health, but I would love to one day be on stage and be doing something artistic. And people say to me, but what you talk about and the way that you do it is art. And I'm like, but it's not. It's campaigning. It's lobbying. It's sharing information. So anyway, during lockdown, I heard this Bengali song, Cherie. So, and it was, I don't speak, my Bengali is quite limited. It's quite broken. But I do understand Bengali very well. There was this one song, and it really just struck a chord, and it was about a woman singing about women empowerment. And some of the words translate to, you know, you can, You can tie me up and lock me up, but you can't take away my spirit. You can't take away my drive. So it was just, it just landed with me. And I heard this song and I was like, I want to sing that song one day. Just if there's just one song once that I could sing, that's the one that I need to sing. And I have a really good friend here. Her name's Sohini Alam. She's a famous Bengali singer. And I phoned her up. And I was like, I want private lessons over Zoom with you. And she was like, yeah, that's fine. That'd be great. Anyway, so we've been doing private lessons on Zoom for, I don't know, probably about 8 or 9 months. And Sohini tells me I'm improving. But you know what, Sheree? Like, it's bad. This is a 20-year project. So we've kind of gone, we started to learn this song and then we've gone, maybe we should find a simpler song and start with that. So it's a work in progress, but I've really enjoyed finding my voice in that way because I'm quite loud and I've learned to project my voice because that's what you do when you're on stage. But to actually use my voice in my mother tongue and also a song which is out of my sort of my British cultural framework is it's fun. So I hold hope that one day I might dance and one day I might even sing, but I think they're retirement projects. They're just, I won't be bragging about them and telling anybody about them. They're just, they're just fun.
Well, I think it's great that you want to do something and then you just go for it and try, even if you think you might not be doing it very well. What else do you want to learn?
God, there's so much that I'd really like to learn. So I'd like to learn to sign. So sign language is definitely something that I would love to take up. And I that's about sort of just learning a different language and one that will universally cut across many languages. So that would be really cool to do. I'd love to. So I have an enormous collection of saris, and yes, I did want to wear one today, but like I run out of time because I'm up against it today. But I'm really, like, I've been learning so much about hand looms and like block print and dyes that have been naturally made and weaves that have been naturally pulled together by artisans who know. And I really believe in supporting ethical fashions. I very rarely buy new clothes, so it's all from charity shops or pre-loved clothes through the internet, so through sari communities. And that is my way of trying to do my little bit for sustainability and the planet. But also it's my way of finding artisans and art that is dying from our South Asian cultures, where we no longer not necessarily have whole communities that were designed around making a particular type of weave, because, you know, big enterprises have come along and taken over, and actually that art is dying. So that would be the other thing that I would definitely like to do, is go on a bit of a tour of Southeast Asia and go and learn about natural products, natural dyes, so I'd love to do that.
So how many saris do you have in your collection?
We're now around 300.
Wow. How often do you wear them?
I wear quite regularly. So I will wear a sari 2-3 times a week. It just depends on what's going on. But I love them. And if I could, I'd live in saris every single day. That every time I've worn a sari on stage, I've had people come up to me and gone, it's so good to see a woman on stage. Not talking about diversity, actually a woman on stage talking about a mainstream issue, but in a and I every time I hear that, it makes me want to do that more. I'm part of a sari wearing community, 160,000 of us or something around the world, maybe more. So many of us have connected on Instagram or Twitter or whatever it is, and so when we were traveling pre-pandemic, every time I was going to another country, whether it was Canada, whether it was, you know, Australia, or in this case, Washington, I usually sort of write to a few people and go, oh, I'm coming to your home city on whenever it was. Are you going to be around? And then I meet these women and we go out for a drink. So I met a lovely woman in Australia when I was there, and we've got some photographs together, and we had, you know, we went out, she took me out and we went to a few bars, and we had went to a restaurant. Me and Neha ended up walking, I think we were walking for about 5 hours around Washington, just sharing each other's lives and having never met before that evening. And it was quite funny when I emailed her, I was like, well, you know, how are we going to, where should we meet? And so we sort of agreed a point. And then we both went, well, how are we going to fully recognize each other? And of course, we'd seen each other's photos. And then we were like, actually, we'll probably be the only women that are wearing Larry saris in. So that was that story. And I think I love this picture again, because it just reminder that women supporting women is really important. And we don't have to know each other forever to actually do that. So some of the friends that I've met through the Sari community have been incredible. And so it's quite symbolic on lots of different levels.
Yeah.
And again, that sort of goes back to the role modeling piece. You know, when we see, traditionally or normally when people see women in saris, you're almost sort of typecast to submissive Asian woman that probably runs a family, but actually the sari is a powerful item.
Amazing. My very last question. We talked about multi-hyphenates a lot. You mentioned wanting to be a dancer, wanting to be an academic. Now, what terms would you use to define who you are? What your identity is?
I'm a mother, I'm a leader, I'm a feminist, I'm an activist, I'm a wannabe dancer singer.
Love that, you're owning it.
And I'm a citizen of the world that's got a lot of curiosity about the world.
Fantastic.